I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. An elephant's faithful, 100%. Theodore Seuss Geisel, Horton Hatches the Egg, 1940.
Highbridge Audio presents Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen, with David Ledoux as Jacob at 23 and John Randolph Jones as Jacob at 90 or 93. Prologue.
Only three people were left under the red and white awning of the grease joint. Grady, me, and the fry cook. Grady and I sat at a battered wooden table, each facing a burger on a dented tin plate. The cook was behind the counter, scraping his griddle with the edge of a spatula. He had turned off the fryer some time ago, but the odor of grease lingered. The rest of the midway, so recently writhing with people, was empty but for a handful of employees and a small group of men waiting to be led to the cooch tent. They glanced nervously from side to side, with hats pulled low and hands thrust deep in their pockets. They wouldn't be disappointed. Somewhere in the back, Barbara and her ample charms awaited. The other townsfolk, rubes, as Uncle Al called them, had already made their way through the menagerie tent and into the big top, which pulsed with frenetic music. The band was whipping through its repertoire at the usual ear-splitting volume. I know the routine by heart. This very moment, the tail end of the grand spectacle was exiting, and Lottie, the aerialist, was ascending her rigging in the center ring. I stared at Grady, trying to process what he was saying. He glanced around and leaned in closer. "Besides," he said, locking eyes with me, "it seems to me you got a lot to lose right now." He raised his eyebrows for emphasis. My heart skipped a beat. Thunderous applause exploded from the big top, and the band slid seamlessly into the Gounod waltz. I turned instinctively toward the menagerie, because this was the cue for the elephant act. Marlene was either preparing to mount or was already sitting on Rosie's head. "I've got to go," I said. "Sit," said Grady. "Eat. If you're thinking of clearing out, it may be a while before you see food again." That moment, the music screeched to a halt. There was an ungodly collision of brass, reed, and percussion. Trombones and piccolos skidded into cacophony. A tuba farted, and the hollow clang of a cymbal wavered out of the big top, over our heads, and into oblivion. Grady froze, crouched over his burger with his pinkies extended and his lips spread wide. I looked from side to side. No one moved a muscle. All eyes were directed at the big top. A few wisps of hay swirled lazily across the hard dirt. "What is it? What's going on?" I said. "Shh," Grady hissed. The band started up again, playing Stars and Stripes Forever. "Oh, Christ. Oh, shit." Grady tossed his food onto the table and leapt up, knocking over the bench. "What? What is it?" I yelled, because he was already running away from me. "The Disaster March," he screamed over his shoulder. I jerked around to the fry cook, who was ripping off his apron. "What the hell's he talking about?" "The Disaster March," he said, wrestling the apron over his head, "means something's gone bad, real bad." "Like what?" "Could be anything. Fire in the big top. Stampede? Whatever. Oh, sweet Jesus, the poor rubes probably don't even know it yet." He ducked under the hinged door and took off. Chaos. Candy butchers vaulting over counters. Workmen staggering out from under tent flaps. roustabouts racing headlong across the lot. Anyone and everyone associated with the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on earth barreled toward the big top. Diamond Joe passed me at the human equivalent of a full gallop. "Jacob, it's the menagerie," he screamed. "The animals are loose. Go, go, go!" He didn't need to tell me twice. Marlena was in that tent. A rumble coursed through me as I approached, and it scared the hell out of me because it was on a register lower than noise. The ground was vibrating. I staggered inside and met a wall of yak, a great expanse of curly-haired chest and churning hoofs, of flared red nostrils and spinning eyes. It galloped past so close, I leapt backward on tiptoe, flush with the canvas, to avoid being impaled on one of its crooked horns. A terrified hyena clung to its shoulders. The concession stand in the center of the tent had been flattened, and in its place was a roiling mass of spots and stripes, of haunches, heels, tails, and claws, all of it roaring, screeching, bellowing, or whinnying. A polar bear towered above it all, slashing blindly with skillet-sized paws. It made contact with a llama and knocked it flat. Boom! The llama hit the ground, its neck and legs splayed like the five points of a star. Chimps screamed and chattered, swinging on ropes to stay above the cats. A wild-eyed zebra zigzagged too close to a crouching lion who swiped, missed, and darted away, his belly close to the ground. My eyes swept the tent, desperate to find Marlena. Instead, I saw a cat slide through the connection leading to the big top. It was a panther, and as its lithe black body disappeared into the canvas tunnel, I braced myself. If the rubes didn't know, they were about to find out. It took several seconds to come. But come it did. One prolonged shriek, followed by another, and then another, and then the whole place exploded with the thunderous sound of bodies trying to shove past other bodies and off the stands. The band screeched to a halt for a second time, and this time stayed silent. I shut my eyes. Please, God, let them leave by the back end. Please, God, don't let them try to come through here. I opened my eyes again and scanned the menagerie, frantic to find her. How hard can it be to find a girl and an elephant, for Christ's sake? When I caught sight of her pink sequins, I nearly cried out in relief. Maybe I did, I don't remember. She was on the opposite side, standing against the side wall, calm as a summer day. Her sequins flashed like liquid diamonds, a shimmering beacon between the multicolored hides. She saw me, too, and held my gaze for what seemed like forever. She was cool, languid, smiling even. I started pushing my way toward her, but something about her expression stopped me cold. That son of a bitch was standing with his back to her, red-faced and bellowing, flapping his arms and swinging his silver-tipped cane. His high-topped silk hat lay on the straw beside him. She reached for something. A giraffe passed between us, its long neck bobbing gracefully even in panic, and when it was gone, I saw that she'd picked up an iron stake. She held it loosely, resting its end on the hard dirt. She looked at me again, bemused. Then her gaze shifted to the back of his bare head. "Oh, Jesus," I said, suddenly understanding. I stumbled forward, screaming, even though there was no hope of my voice reaching her. "Don't do it! Don't do it!" She lifted the stake high in the air and brought it down, splitting his head like a watermelon. His pate opened, his eyes grew wide, and his mouth froze into an O. He fell to his knees and then toppled forward into the straw. I was too stunned to move, even as a young orangutan flung its elastic arms around my legs. So long ago. So long. But still, it haunts me. I don't talk much about those days. Never did. I don't know why. I worked on circuses for nearly 7 years. And if that isn't fodder for conversation, I don't know what is. Actually, I do know why. I never trusted myself. I was afraid I'd let it slip. I knew how important it was to keep her secret. And keep it I did, for the rest of her life, and then beyond. In 70 years, I've never told a blessed soul.
Chapter 1.
I am 90. Or 93. One or the other. When you're 5, you know your age down to the month. Even in your 20s, you know how old you are. I'm 23, you say, or maybe 27. But then in your 30s, something strange starts to happen. It's a mere hiccup at first, an instant of hesitation. How old are you? You start confidently, but then you stop. You were going to say 33, but you're not. You're 35. And then you're bothered because you wonder if this is the beginning of the end. It is, of course, but it's decades before you admit it. You start to forget words. They're on the tip of your tongue, but instead of eventually dislodging, they stay there. You go upstairs to fetch something. And by the time you get there, you can't remember what it was you were after. You call your child by the names of all your other children, and finally the dog, before you get to his. Sometimes you forget what day it is. And finally you forget the year. Actually, it's not so much that I've forgotten. It's more like I've stopped keeping track. We're past the millennium, that much I know. Such a fuss and bother over nothing. All those young folks clucking with worry and buying canned food because somebody was too lazy to leave space for 4 digits instead of 2. But that could have been last month or 3 years ago. And besides, what does it really matter? What's the difference between 3 weeks or 3 years, or even 3 decades, of mushy peas, tapioca, and Depends undergarments? I'm 90, or 93, one or the other. Either there's been an accident, or there's road work, because a gaggle of old ladies is glued to the window at the end of the hall like children of jailbirds. They're spidery and frail. Their hair as fine as mist. Most of them are a good decade younger than me, and this astounds me. Even as your body betrays you, your mind denies it. I'm parked in the hallway with my walker. And I've come a long way since my hip fracture, and thank the Lord for that. For a while, it looked like I wouldn't walk again. That's how I got talked into coming here in the first place. But every couple of hours, I get up and walk a few steps. And with every day, I get a little bit farther before feeling the need to turn around. There may be life in the old dog yet. There are 5 of them now, white-headed old things huddled together and pointing crooked fingers at the glass. I wait a while to see if they wander off. They don't. I glance down, check that my brakes are on, and rise carefully, steadying myself on the wheelchair's arm while making the perilous transfer to the walker. Once I'm squared away, I clutch the gray rubber pads on the arms and shove it forward until my elbows are extended, which turns out to be exactly 1 floor tile. I drag my left foot forward, make sure it's steady, and then pull the other up beside it. Shove, drag, wait, drag, shove, drag, wait, drag. The hallway is long, and my feet don't respond the way they used to. It's not camel's kind of lameness, thank God, but it slows me down nonetheless. Poor old camel. It's been years since I thought of him. His feet flopped loosely at the end of his legs, so he had to lift his knees high and throw them forward. My feet drag, as though they're weighted, and because my back is stooped, I end up looking down at my slippers framed by the walker. It takes a while to get to the end of the hall, but I do, and on my own pins, too. I'm pleased as punch, although once there I realize I still have to find my way back. They part from me, these old ladies. These are the vital ones, the ones who can either move on their own steam or have friends to wheel them around. These old girls still have their marbles, and they're good to me. I'm a rarity here, an old man among a sea of widows whose hearts still ache for their lost men. "Oh, here," clucks Hazel. "Let's give Jacob a look." She pulls Dolly's wheelchair a few feet back and shuffles up beside me, clasping her hands, her milky eyes flashing. "Oh, it's so exciting. They've been at it all morning." I edge up to the glass and raise my face, squinting against the sunlight. It's so bright it takes a moment for me to make out what's happening. Then the forms take shape. In the park at the end of the block is an enormous canvas tent, thickly striped in white and magenta with an unmistakable peaked top. My ticker lurches so hard I clutch a fist to my chest. "Jacob! Oh, Jacob!" cries Hazel. "Oh, dear! Oh, dear!" Her hands flutter in confusion, and she turns toward the hall. "Nurse! Nurse! Hurry, it's Mr. Jankowski." "I'm fine," I say, coughing and pounding my chest. "That's the problem with these old ladies. They're always afraid you're about to keel over. Hazel, I'm fine." But it's too late. I hear the squeak, squeak, squeak of rubber soles, and moments later, I'm engulfed by nurses. I guess I won't have to worry about getting back to my chair after all. "So, what's on the menu tonight?" I grumble as I'm steered into the dining room. "Porridge? Mushy peas? Pablum? Oh, let me guess, it's tapioca, isn't it? Is it tapioca? Or are we calling it rice pudding tonight?" "Oh, Mr. Jankowski, you are a card," the nurse says flatly. She doesn't need to answer, and she knows it. This being Friday, we're having the usual nutritious but uninteresting combination of meatloaf, creamed corn, reconstituted mashed potatoes, and gravy that may have been waved over a piece of beef at some point in its life. And they wonder why I lose weight. I know some of us don't have teeth, but I do. And I want pot roast. My wife's, complete with leathery bay leaves. I want carrots. I want potatoes boiled in their skins. And I want a deep, rich Cabernet Sauvignon to wash it all down. Not apple juice from a tin. But above all, I want corn on the cob. Sometimes I think that if I had to choose between an ear of corn or making love to a woman, I'd choose the corn. Not that I wouldn't love to have a final roll in the hay. I am a man yet, and some things never die. But the thought of those sweet kernels bursting between my teeth sure sets my mouth to watering. It's fantasy, I know that. Neither will happen. I just like to weigh the options, as though I were standing in front of Solomon. A final roll in the hay or an ear of corn. What a wonderful dilemma. Sometimes I substitute an apple for the corn. Everyone at every table is talking about the circus. Those who can talk, that is, the silent ones, the ones with frozen faces and withered limbs, or whose heads and hands shake too violently to hold utensils. I sit around the edges of the room, accompanied by aides who spoon little bits of food into their mouths and then coax them into masticating. They remind me of baby birds, except they're lacking all enthusiasm. With the exception of a slight grinding of the jaw, their faces remain still and horrifyingly vacant. Horrifying because I'm well aware of the road I'm on. I'm not there yet, but it's coming. There's only one way to avoid it, and I can't say I much care for that option either. The nurse parks me in front of my meal. The gravy on the meatloaf has already formed the skin. I poke experimentally with my fork. Its meniscus jiggles, mocking me. Disgusted, I look up and lock eyes with Joseph McGinty. He's sitting opposite, a newcomer, an interloper, a retired barrister with a square jaw, pitted nose, and great floppy ears. The ears remind me of Rosie, although nothing else does. She was a fine soul, and he's... Well, he's a retired lawyer. I can't imagine what the nurses thought a lawyer and a veterinarian would have in common. But they wheeled him on over to sit opposite me that first night. And here he's been ever since. He glares at me, his jaw moving back and forth like a cow chewing cud. Incredible. He's actually eating the stuff. The old ladies chatter like schoolgirls, blissfully unaware. They're here until Sunday, says Doris. Billy stopped to find out. Yes, two shows on Saturday and one on Sunday. Randall and his girls are taking me tomorrow, says Norma. She turns to me. Jacob, will you be going? I open my mouth to answer, but before I can, Doris blurts out, And did you see those horses? My word, they're pretty. We had horses when I was a girl. Oh, how I love to ride. She looks into the distance, and for a split second, I can see how lovely she was as a young woman. Do you remember when the circus traveled by train? Says Hazel. The posters would appear a few days ahead. They'd cover every surface in town. You couldn't see a brick in between. Golly, yes, I certainly do, Norma says. They put posters on the side of our barn one year. The men told Father they used a special glue that would dissolve 2 days after the show. But darned if our barn wasn't still plastered with them months later, she chuckles, shaking her head. Father was fit to be tied. And then a few days later, the train would pull in, always at the crack of dawn. My father used to take us down to the tracks to watch them unload. Gosh, that was something to see. And then the parade, and the smell of peanuts roasting, and Cracker Jack, and candy apples, and ice cream, and lemonade, and the sawdust it would get in your nose. I used to carry water for the elephants, says McGinty. I drop my fork and look up. He is positively dripping with self-satisfaction, just waiting for the girls to fawn over him. You did not, I say. There is a beat of silence. I beg your pardon, he says. You did not carry water for the elephants. Yes, I most certainly did. No, you didn't. Are you calling me a liar? He says slowly. If you say you carried water for elephants, I am. The girls stare at me with open mouths. My heart's pounding. I know I shouldn't do this, but somehow I can't help myself. How dare you? McGinty braces, his knobby hands on the edge of the table. Stringy tendons appear in his forearms. Listen, pal, I say. For decades, I've heard old coots like you talk about carrying water for elephants, and I'm telling you now, it never happened. Old coot. Old coot! McGinty pushes himself upright, sending his wheelchair flying backward. He points a gnarled finger at me, and then drops as though felled by dynamite. He vanishes beneath the edge of the table, his eyes perplexed, his mouth still open. Nurse! Oh, nurse! Cry the old ladies. There's the familiar patter of crepe-soled shoes, and moments later two nurses haul McGinty up by the arms. He grumbles, making feeble attempts to shake them off. A third nurse, a pneumatic black girl in pale pink, stands at the end of the table with her hands on her hips. What on earth is going on? She asks. That old SOB called me a liar, that's what, says McGinty, safely restored to his chair. He straightens his shirt, lifts his grizzled chin, and crosses his arms in front of him. And an old coot. Oh, I'm sure that's not what Mr. Jankowski meant, the girl in pink says. It most certainly is, I say. And he is, too. Carried water for the elephants, indeed. Do you have any idea how much an elephant drinks? Well, I never, says Norma, pursing her lips and shaking her head. I'm sure I don't know what's gotten into you, Mr. Jankowski. Oh, I see, I see. So that's how it is. It's an outrage, says McGinty, leaning slightly toward Norma, now that he sees he's got the popular vote. I don't see why I should have to put up with being called a liar. And an old coot, I remind him. Mr. Jankowski, says the black girl, her voice raised. She comes behind me and releases the brakes on my wheelchair. I think maybe you should spend some time in your room until you calm down. Now wait just a minute, I shout, as she swings me away from the table and toward the door. I don't need to calm down, and besides, I haven't eaten. I'll bring your dinner in, she says from behind. I don't want it in my room. Take me back. You can't do this to me. But it appears she can. She wheels me down the hall at lightning speed and turns sharply into my room. She jams the brakes on so hard the whole chair jars. I'll just go back, I say, as she raises my footrests. You'll do no such thing, she says, setting my feet on the floor. This isn't fair, I say, my voice rising in a whine. I've been sitting at that table forever. He's been there 2 weeks. Why is everyone siding with him? Nobody's siding with anyone. She leans forward, slinging her shoulder under mine. As she lifts me, my head rests next to hers. Her hair is chemically straightened and smells of flowers. When she sets me on the edge of the bed, I am at eye level with her pale pink bosom and her name tag. Rosemary, I say. Yes, Mr. Jankowski, she says. He is lying, you know. I know no such thing, and neither do you. I do, though. I was on a show. She blinks, irritated. How do you mean? I hesitate, and then change my mind. Never mind, I say. Did you work on a circus? I said, never mind. There's a heartbeat of uncomfortable silence. Mr. McGinty could have been seriously hurt, you know, she says, arranging my legs. She works quickly, efficiently, but stops just short of being summary. No, he couldn't. Lawyers are indestructible. She stares at me for a long time, actually looking at me as a person. For a moment, I think I sense a chink. Then she snaps back into action. Is your family taking you to the circus this weekend? Oh, yes, I say with some pride. Someone comes every Sunday. Like clockwork. She shakes out a blanket and spreads it over my legs. Would you like me to get your dinner? No, I say. There's an awkward silence. I realize I should have added thank you, but it's too late now. All right, then, she says. I'll be back in a while to see if you need anything else. Yep, I'm sure she will. That's what they always say. But dagnabbit, here she is. Now don't tell anyone, she says, bustling in and sliding my dinner table cum vanity over my lap. She sets down a paper napkin, plastic fork, and a bowl of fruit that actually looks appetizing, with strawberries, melon, and apple. I packed it for my break. I'm on a diet. Do you like fruit, Mr. Jankowski? I would answer except that my hand is over my mouth, and it's trembling. Apple, for God's sake. She pats my other hand and leaves the room, discreetly ignoring my tears. I slip a piece of apple into my mouth, savoring its juices. The buzzing fluorescent fixture above me casts its harsh light on my crooked fingers as they pluck pieces of fruit from the bowl. They look foreign to me. Surely they can't be mine. Age is a terrible thief. Just when you're getting the hang of life, it knocks your legs out from under you and stoops your back. It makes you ache and muddies your head and silently spreads cancer throughout your spouse. Metastatic, the doctor said. A matter of weeks or months. But my darling was as frail as a bird. She died 9 days later. After 61 years together, she simply clutched my hand and exhaled. Although there are times I'd give anything to have her back, I'm glad she went first. Losing her was like being cleft down the middle. It was the moment it all ended for me, and I wouldn't have wanted her to go through that. Being a survivor stinks. I used to think I preferred getting old to the alternative, but now I'm not so sure. Sometimes the monotony of bingo and sing-alongs and ancient, dusty people parked in the hallway in wheelchairs makes me long for death, particularly when I remember that I am one of the ancient, dusty people, filed away like some worthless tchotchke. But there's nothing to be done about it. All I can do is put in time, waiting for the inevitable, observing as the ghosts of my past rattle around my vacuous present. They crash and bang and make themselves at home, mostly because there's no competition. I've stopped fighting them. They're crashing and banging around in there now. Make yourselves at home, boys. Stay a while. Oh, sorry. I see you already have. Damn ghosts.
Chapter 2
I'm 23, and sitting beside Catherine Hale. Or rather, she's sitting beside me, because she came into the lecture hall after I did, sliding nonchalantly across the bench until our thighs were touching, and then shrinking away with a blush as though the contact were accidental. Catherine is one of only 4 women in the class of 31, and her cruelty knows no bounds. I've lost track of all the times I've thought, oh God, she's finally gonna let me, only to be hit in the face with, dear God, she wants me to stop now? I am, as far as I can tell, the oldest male virgin on the face of the earth. Certainly no one else my age is willing to admit it. Even my roommate Edward has claimed victory, although I'm inclined to believe the closest he's ever come to a naked woman was between the covers of one of his 8 pagers. Not too long ago, some of the guys on my football team paid a woman a quarter apiece to let them do it, one after the other in the cattle barn. As much as I had hoped to leave my virginity behind at Cornell, I couldn't bring myself to take part. I simply couldn't do it. So, in 10 days, after 6 long years of dissections, castrations, foalings, and shoving my arm up a cow's rear end more times than I care to remember, I and my faithful shadow, Virginity, will leave Ithaca and join my father's veterinary practice in Norwich. And here you can see evidence of thickening of the distal small intestine, says Professor Willard McGovern, his voice devoid of inflection. Using a pointer, he pokes languidly at the twisted intestines of a dead salt and pepper milk goat. This, along with enlarged mesenteric lymph nodes, indicates a clear pattern of... The door squeaks open, and McGovern turns, his pointer still buried in the doe's belly. Dean Wilkins walks briskly into the room and mounts the stairs to the podium. The two men confer, standing so close their foreheads nearly touch. McGovern listens to Wilkins' urgent whispers and then turns to scan the rows of students with worried eyes. All around me, students fidget. Catherine sees me looking and slides one knee over the other, smoothing her skirt with languorous fingers. I swallow hard and look away. Jacob Jankowski... In my shock, I drop my pencil. It rolls under Catherine's feet. I clear my throat and rise quickly. 50-some pairs of eyes turn to look at me. Yes, sir? Can we have a word, please? I close my notebook and set it on the bench. Catherine retrieves my pencil and lets her fingers linger on mine as she hands it to me. I make my way to the aisle, bumping knees and stepping on toes. Whispers follow me to the front of the room. Dean Wilkins stares at me. Come with us, he says. I've done something. That much is clear. I follow him into the hallway. McGovern walks out behind me and closes the door. For a moment, the two of them stand silently, arms crossed, faces stern. My mind races, dissecting my every recent move. Did they go through the dorm? Did they find Edward's liquor, or maybe even the 8 pagers? Dear Lord, if I get expelled now, my father will kill me. No question about it. Never mind what it will do to my mother. Okay, so maybe I drank a little whiskey, but it's not like I had anything to do with the fiasco in the cattle. Dean Wilkins takes a deep breath, raises his eyes to mine, and claps a hand on my shoulder. Son, there's been an accident. A slight pause. An automobile accident. Another pause. Longer this time. Your parents were involved. I stare at him, willing him to continue. Are they... Will they... I'm sorry, son. It was instant. There was nothing anyone could do. I stare at his face, trying to maintain eye contact, but it's difficult because he's zooming away from me, receding to the end of a long black tunnel. Stars explode in my peripheral vision. You okay, son? What? Are you okay? Suddenly he's right in front of me again. I blink, wondering what he means. How the hell can I be okay? Then I realize he's asking whether I'm going to cry. He clears his throat and continues. You'll have to go back today to make a positive identification. I'll drive you to the station. The police superintendent, a member of our congregation, is waiting on the platform in street clothes. He greets me with an awkward nod and stiff handshake. Almost as an afterthought, he pulls me into a violent embrace. He pats my back loudly and expels me with a shove and a sniff. Then he drives me to the hospital in his own car, a 2-year-old phaeton that must have cost the earth. So many things people would have done differently had they known what would happen that fateful October. The coroner leads us to the basement and slips through a door, leaving us in the hall. After a few minutes, a nurse appears, holding the door open in wordless invitation. There are no windows. There's a clock on one wall, but the room is otherwise bare. The floor is linoleum, olive green and white, and in the middle are two gurneys. Each has a sheet-covered body on it. I can't process this. I can't even tell which end is which. Are you ready? The coroner asks, moving between them. I swallow and nod. A hand appears on my shoulder. It belongs to the superintendent. The coroner exposes first my father, and then my mother. They don't look like my parents, and yet they can't be anyone else. Death is all over them, in the mottled patterns of their battered torsos, the eggplant purple on bloodless white in the sinking hollowed eye sockets. My mother, so pretty and meticulous in life, wears a stiff grimace in death. Her hair is matted and bloodied, pressed into the hollow of her crushed skull. Her mouth is open, her chin receding as though she were snoring. I turn as vomit explodes from my mouth. Someone is there with a kidney dish, but I overshoot and hear liquid splash across the floor, splattering against the wall. Hear it because my eyes are squeezed shut. I vomit again and again until there's nothing left. Despite this, I remain doubled over and heaving until I wonder if it's possible to turn inside out. They take me somewhere and plant me in a chair. A kindly nurse in a starched white uniform brings coffee, which sits on the table next to me until it grows cold. Later, the chaplain comes and sits beside me. He asks if there is anyone he can call. I mumble that all my relatives are in Poland. He asks about neighbors and members of our church. But for the life of me, I can't come up with a single name. Not one. I'm not sure I could come up with my own if asked. When he leaves, I slip out. It's a little over 2 miles to our house, and I arrive just as the last sliver of sun slips beneath the horizon. The driveway is empty, of course. I stop in the backyard, holding my valise, and staring at the long, flat building behind the house. There's a new sign above the entrance, the lettering glossy and black. E. Jankowski and Son, Doctors of Veterinary Medicine. After a while, I turn to the house, climb the stoop, and push open the back door. My father's prized possession, a Philco radio, sits on the kitchen counter. My mother's blue sweater hangs on the back of a chair. There are ironed linens on the kitchen table, a vase of wilted violets, an overturned mixing bowl, 2 plates, and a handful of cutlery set to dry on a checked dish towel spread out by the sink. This morning, I had parents. This morning, they ate breakfast. I fall to my knees right there on the back stoop, howling into splayed hands. The ladies of the church auxiliary, alerted to my return by the superintendent's wife, swoop down on me within the hour. I'm still on the stoop, my face pressed into my knees. I hear gravel crunching under tires, car doors slamming, and next thing I know, I'm surrounded by doughy flesh, flowered prints, and gloved hands. I'm pressed against soft bosoms, poked by veiled hats, and engulfed by jasmine, lavender, and rose water. Death is a formal affair, and they're dressed in their Sunday best. They pat, and they fuss, and above all, they cluck. Such a shame, such a shame, and such good people, too. It's hard to make sense of such a tragedy, surely it is. But the good Lord works in mysterious ways. They will take care of everything. The guest room at Jim and Mabel Norrader's house is already made up. I am not to worry about a thing. They take my valise and herd me toward the running car. A grim-faced Jim Norrader is behind the wheel, gripping it with both hands. 2 days after I bury my parents, I'm summoned to the offices of Edmund Hyde, Esquire, to hear the details of their estate. I sit in a hard leather chair across from the man himself as it gradually sinks in that there is nothing to discuss. At first, I think he's mocking me, Apparently my father has been taking payment in the form of beans and eggs for nearly 2 years.
Beans and eggs?
My voice cracks in disbelief.
Beans and eggs?
And chickens and other goods.
I don't understand.
It's what people have, son. The community's been hit right hard, and your father was trying to help out. Couldn't stand by and watch animals suffer.
But I don't understand. Even if he took payment in a
whatever, how does that make everything belong to the bank? They fell behind on their mortgage.
My parents didn't have a mortgage.
He looks uncomfortable, holds his steepled fingers in front of him. Well, yes, actually they did.
No, they didn't,
I argue. They've lived here for nearly 30 years. My father put away every cent he ever made. The bank failed.
I narrow my eyes. I thought you just said it all goes to the bank.
He sighs deeply. It's a different bank. The one that gave them the mortgage when the other one closed, he says. I can't tell if he's trying to give the appearance of patience and failing miserably, or is blatantly trying to make me leave. I pause, weighing my options.
What about the things in the house? In the practice, I say finally.
It all goes to the bank.
What if I want to fight it?
How?
What if I come back and take over the practice and try to make the payments?
It doesn't work like that. It's not yours to take over.
I stare at Edmund Hyde in his expensive suit, behind his expensive desk, in front of his leather-bound books.
Behind him, the sun streaks through the lead-pane windows. I'm filled with sudden loathing. I'll bet he's never taken payment in the form of beans and eggs in his life.
I lean forward and make eye contact. I want this to be his problem, too. What am I supposed to do? I ask slowly.
I don't know, son. I wish I did. The country's fallen on hard times, and that's a fact. He leans back in his chair, his fingers still steepled.
He cocks his head as though an idea has just occurred to him.
I suppose you could go west, he muses.
It dawns on me that if I don't get out of this office right now, I'm going to slug him. I rise, replace my hat, and leave. When I reach the sidewalk, something else dawns on me. I can think of only one reason my parents would need a mortgage: to pay my Ivy League tuition. The pain from this sudden realization is so intense I double over, clutching my stomach.
Because no other option occurs to me, I return to school, a temporary solution at best. My room and board is paid up until the end of the year, but that is only 6 days away. I've missed the entire week of review lectures. Everyone is eager to help. Catherine hands me her notes and then hugs me in a way that suggests I might get different results if I were to attempt the usual quest. I pull away.
For the first time in living memory, I have no interest in sex. I can't eat. I can't sleep. And I certainly can't study. I stare at a single paragraph for a quarter of an hour but can't absorb it. How can I, when behind the words on the white background of the paper, I'm watching an endless loop of my parents' deaths? Watching as their cream-colored Buick flies through the guardrail and over the side of the bridge to avoid old Mr. McPherson's red truck. Old Mr. McPherson, who confessed as he was led from the scene that he wasn't entirely sure what side of the road he should have been on and thinks that maybe he hit the gas instead of the brake. Old Mr. McPherson, who showed up at church one legendary Easter without trousers. The proctor shuts the door and takes his seat. He glances at the wall clock and waits until the minute hand wobbles forward. You may begin. 52 exam booklets flip over. Some people riffle through it. Others start writing immediately. I do neither. 40 minutes later, I've yet to touch pencil to paper. I stare at the booklet in desperation. There are diagrams, numbers, lines, and charts, strings of words with terminal punctuation at the end. Some period, some question marks, and none of it makes sense. I wonder briefly if it is even English. I try it in Polish, but that doesn't work either. It might as well be hieroglyphics. A woman coughs and I jump. A bead of sweat falls from my forehead onto my booklet. I wipe it off with my sleeve, then pick the booklet up. Maybe if I bring it closer, or hold it farther away, I can see now that it is in English, or rather that the individual words are English, but I cannot read from one to another with any sense of continuity. A second drop of sweat falls. I scan the room. Catherine is writing quickly, her light brown hair falling over her face. She's left-handed, and because she writes in pencil, her left arm is silver from wrist to elbow. Beside her, Edward yanks himself upright, glances at the clock in panic, and slumps back over his booklet. I turn away toward a window. Snatches of sky peek through leaves, a mosaic in blue and green that shifts gently with the wind. I stare into it, allowing my focus to soften, looking beyond the leaves and branches. A squirrel bounds fatly across my sightline, full tail cocked. I shove my chair back with a violent screech and stand up. My brow is beaded, my fingers shaking. 52 faces turn to look. I should know these people. And up until a week ago, I did. I knew where their families lived. I knew what their fathers did. I knew whether they had siblings and whether they liked them. Hell, I even remember the ones who had to drop out after the crash. Henry Winchester, whose father stepped off the ledge of the Board of Trade building in Chicago. Alistair Barnes, whose father shot himself in the head. Reginald Monty, who tried unsuccessfully to live in a car when his family could no longer pay for his room and board. Bucky Hayes, whose unemployed father simply wandered off. But these ones, the ones who remain, nothing. I stare at these faces without features, these blank ovals with hair, looking from one to the next with increasing desperation. I'm aware of a heavy, wet noise, and realize it's me. I'm gasping for breath. Jacob? The face nearest me has a mouth and it's moving. The voice is timid, unsure. Are you okay? I blink, unable to focus. A second later, I cross the room and toss the exam booklet on the proctor's desk. Finished already, he says, reaching for it. I hear paper rustling as I head for the door. Wait, he calls after me. You haven't even started. You can't leave. If you leave, I can't let you. The door cuts off his final words. As I march across the quad, I look up at Dean Wilkins' office. He's standing at the window, watching. I walk until the edge of town, and then veer off to follow the train tracks. I walk until after dark, and the moon is high, and then for several hours after. I walk until my legs hurt and my feet blister, and then I stop because I'm tired and hungry, and have no idea where I am. It's as though I've been sleepwalking and suddenly woken to find myself here. The only sign of civilization is the track, which rests on a raised bed of gravel. There's forest on one side and a small clearing on the other. From somewhere nearby, I hear water trickling, and I pick my way toward it, guided by the moonlight. The stream is a couple of feet wide at most. It runs along the tree line at the far side of the clearing and then cuts off into the woods. I peel off my shoes and socks and sit at its edge. When I first submerge my feet in the frigid water, they hurt so badly I yank them out again. I persist, dunking them for longer and longer periods until the cold finally numbs my blisters. I rest my soles against the rocky bottom and let the water wriggle between my toes. Eventually, the cold causes its own ache, and I lie back on the bank, resting my head on a flat stone while my feet dry. A coyote howls in the distance, a sound both lonely and familiar, and I sigh, allowing my eyes to close.
When it is answered by a yipping only a few dozen yards to my left, I sit forward abruptly. The faraway coyote howls again, and this time is answered by a train whistle. I pull on my socks and shoes and rise, staring at the edge of the clearing. The train is closer now, rattling and thumping toward me. Chunk, 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 chunk. I wipe my hands on my thighs and walk toward the track, stopping a few yards short. The acrid stink of oil fills my nose. The whistle shrieks again. A massive engine explodes around the bend and barrels past. So huge and so close, I'm hit by a wall of wind. It churns out rolling clouds of billowing smoke, a fat black rope that coils over the cars behind it. The sight, the sound, the stink are too much. I watch, stunned, as half a dozen flat cars whoosh by, loaded with what looks like wagons, although I can't quite make them out because the moon is gone behind a cloud. I snap out of my stupor. There are people on that train. It matters not a whit where it's going, because wherever it is, it's away from coyotes and toward civilization. Food, possible employment, maybe even a ticket back to Ithaca, although I haven't a cent to my name and no reason to think they'd take me back. And what if they will? There's no home to return to, no practice to join. More flat cars pass, loaded with what look like telephone poles. I look behind them, straining to see what follows. The moon slips out for a second, shining its bluish light on what might be freight cars. I start running, moving the same direction as the train. My feet slip in the sloping gravel. It's like running in sand, and I overcompensate by pitching forward. I stumble, flailing and trying to regain my balance before any part of me comes between the huge steel wheels and the track. I recover and pick up speed, scanning each car for something to grab onto. Three flash by, locked up tight. They're followed by stock cars. Their doors are open but filled by the exposed tail ends of horses. This is so odd, I take note, even though I'm running beside a moving train in the middle of nowhere. I slow to a jog and finally stop. Winded and very nearly hopeless, I turn my head. There's an open door three cars behind me. I lunge forward again, counting as they pass. One, two, three. I reach for the iron grab bar and fling myself upward. My left foot and elbow hit first, and then my chin, which smashes onto the metal edging. I cling tightly with all three. The noise is deafening, and my jawbone bangs rhythmically on the iron edging. I smell either blood or rust and wonder briefly if I've destroyed my teeth before realizing the point is in serious danger of becoming moot. I'm balanced perilously on the edge of the doorway with my right leg pointed at the undercarriage. With my right hand, I cling to the grab bar. With my left, I claw the floorboard so desperately the wood peels off under my nails. I'm losing purchase. I have almost no tread on my shoes, and my left foot slides in short jerks toward the door. My right leg now dangles so far under the train, I'm sure I'm going to lose it. I brace for it even, squeezing my eyes shut and clenching my teeth. After a couple of seconds, I realize I'm still intact. I open my eyes and weigh my options. There are only two choices here, and since there's no dismounting without going under the train, I count to three and buck upward with everything I've got. I manage to get my left knee up over the edge. Using foot, knee, chin, elbow, and fingernails, I scrape my way inside and collapse on the floor. I lie panting, utterly spent. Then, I realize I'm facing a dim light. I jerk upright on my elbow. Four men are sitting on rough burlap feed sacks, playing cards by the light of a kerosene lantern. One of them, a shrunken old man with stubble and a hollow face, has an earthenware jug tipped up to his lips. In his surprise, he seems to have forgotten to put it back down. He does so now and wipes his mouth with the back of his sleeve.
"Well, well, well," he says slowly. "What have we here?"
Two of the men sit perfectly still, staring at me over the top of fanned cards. The fourth climbs to his feet and steps forward. He is a hulking brute with a thick black beard. His clothes are filthy, and the brim of his hat looks like someone has taken a bite out of it. I scramble to my feet and stumble backward, only to find that there's nowhere to go. I twist my head around and discover that I'm up against one of a great many bundles of candy.